The lust of the eyes, boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God remains forever, lives forever. The believer is not to love the world. Pretty clear. The believer is not to love the world. Because it's not just that it's futile or evil, it's that it is a system of evil, the world is. It's directed by evil spirits, Satan. It is run through false teaching at every level of society. And it is stimulated by sinful human desire. You cannot love that and love the good Father above. They're polar opposites. They just don't go together. But here we are. We're living in the world. We're out of place. We don't belong. We don't fit in. We're in the world, but not what? Of the world. So there's this continuous tension in our lives as believers. Romans 12 says, do not be conformed to the world. How can we live for God when the world around us is always trying to conform us to its values and its way of thinking, to press us into its mold? That tension obviously involves temptation. And sometimes Christians succumb to temptation. Sometimes the mindset of the world penetrates into our heads, and we wish it didn't, but it's in there. And then, like that Arabian proverb, if the camel of worldliness gets its nose into the tent of the church, the whole body is soon to follow. That worldliness, when it enters into the tent of the church, so to say, it causes a lot of problems. It causes a lot of conflicts in the church, sometimes terrible conflict. The Holy Spirit understands the danger of that dynamic when worldliness gets into the church. And so the Holy Spirit moved James, the Lord's brother, to write a part of his letter to excise and remove worldliness from the thinking of believers, the way a surgeon might excise and cut out and discard, hopefully, a portion of cancerous tissue. God is working to swat at that nose that's sticking its nose under the tent of the church and bringing worldliness into it. But you and I need to cooperate. You and I need to cooperate with the Holy Spirit as He tries to remove that worldliness from us. For the less worldliness that is in our lives, the less worldliness will be in the church. Do you agree? And so we're going to read James. You could turn there. We're back in James this morning. Chapter 4, we'll read verses 1 through 10. I don't know. We'll get to verses 1 and 2 maybe today. But it's a wonderful passage. We'll see. There's a lot to learn about worldliness there, and maybe some of it will be surprising to you. James chapter 4, verses 1 through 10. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit which He has made to dwell in us. But He gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable, and mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. Worldliness is a common theme in some churches, but in other churches it's not heard too much about at all. Yet truthfully, in most churches, it is a dreadful reality that the Scriptures warn us against. You could tell at first reading of this passage that this is a strong warning to the churches against worldliness. It has some very strong exhortations at the end as to what we need to do about it. Even as believers, if we do not have our guard up, the world will press us into its mold and press into us as well. You and I are not immune. We are susceptible to contracting this disease called worldliness. And yet when I say that, worldliness is often misunderstood and it's misstated when people talk about it. They say, yeah, we're not supposed to be worldly. What's that? What does it mean to be worldly? It's been my experience, at least in conservative Protestant churches, that typically when they think about worldliness or talk about worldliness, they do it in terms of kinds of entertainment that is to be avoided. So like, oh, you shouldn't listen to that or watch that. That's a worldly thing. Or that kind of music we should not listen to because that's worldly. Or certain kind of clothing, hip clothing that maybe might be fashionable in society, and people say, that's worldly. Or some kind of language, or there are many examples of what folks would say, that's worldliness. And they don't want that in the church. They want to get that out of the church, and so they talk about that as worldliness. Gambling maybe would be another example, because there are a lot of things that happen bad around gambling and gamblers and betting and all the covetousness that goes along with that. In some quarters, they kind of associate any playing of cards or any kind of gaming at all as being evil and wicked. And so all of that is thrown out and is considered to be worldly. I know in the past, there were certain kind of hairstyles or clothing styles that were considered worldly. And the church doesn't want their young people to imitate those kinds of things. You know, whether today it's tattoos or body piercings or long hair, different people have different ideas as to what they think is worldly and worldliness. In my days, growing up in the 70s and getting saved at the end of the 70s, the thing you were not supposed to have was a beard. And that was a problem for me because I had a beard. I'm a hairy guy. And the first time I went to seminary at age 22, they said, why do you have a beard? And I was the first person they ever let in the seminary who had a beard, because having a beard was sort of associated with the rebellious culture that grew beard and grew long hair and all the rest of that is considered to be a worldly thing. God's word describes worldliness, though, differently. It describes it in a way maybe most of us haven't thought about. It describes worldliness mostly as selfish motivation in our hearts, ungodly desire that's in there and comes out with different expressions in different people, uncontrolled lusts, cravings for money, cravings for power, cravings for prestige. See, it's very easy to point to someone and say, you know, they're smoking, they're chewing tobacco, they're worldly. You know, just say, that's what worldliness is. It's very easy to do that, for many church people to withdraw from that and say, well, I'm not worldly, that's what worldliness is, that's not me. But really, what about us? What really is worldliness? Are we too worldly? My Greek professor in my Ephesians class, when he was talking to young seminarians, these are all men, they're getting ready for ministry, and he gave us some advice. He said, don't touch the gold, don't touch the girls, and don't touch the glory. And in just that little bit of advice, he said an awful lot, didn't he? I mean, that's stuck in my head, I know that. These are things not to go after. This is what the world is all wanting. The world wants, at least from the young man's perspective, the gold. And wants the girls and wants the credit and the glory. That's what the world really is all about. Here I think James is taking his sanctified finger and he's pinpointing what worldliness is. And he's saying, you know where it is? It's not necessarily about what you wear, although that often is an expression of your heart. But it really is what is going on in your heart, right? And with a stunning contrast, he places worldliness in opposition to friendship with God. Some people would have a hard time with that. Can I get along with folks in the world and be worldly and also be a friend of God? And this passage says, no, you can't. You're going to have to make a choice. You're going to have to decide which side you want to stand on. So he is urging us to choose friendship with God. That seems obvious. And to reject the practices and the heart and the motives of the world. So we're kind of going to view worldliness as a disease here. And to cure us of worldliness as a disease, James, like a good spiritual surgeon, is going to take three actions. First, he's going to diagnose worldliness in verses 1 through 3. That's where we're going to be today, looking at what is worldliness, how it is seen, how it is understood. That's in verses 1 through 3, diagnosing worldliness. And then he's going to cut worldliness out of us with a very strong rebuke in verses 4 and 5. And then last, he's going to provide the medicine, how to get rid of worldliness, have it be gone from our lives, and that is in those staccato-like but very strong exhortations in verses 6 through 10. Okay, the diagnosis, verses 1 through 3, cutting out worldliness, verses 4 and 5, and then providing the medicine in verses 6 through 10. Look at verse 1 and verse 2 with me again, would you? He says, and he asks really, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? Let me stop there. Some have even questioned whether chapter 4 should have started here or if chapter 3 should have just kept going, because the topic seems very similar to what was written at the end of chapter 3. Do you remember that? You can look back at that. Talking about the worldly wisdom that produced all these conflicts, and then the real wisdom that came down from above, that was first what? It was pure, remember that? And it was peaceable and it was gentle. And then those who were really on God's side, they worked for peace in God's church. But we know that even though that's the wisdom that comes from God, often the experience in church is the opposite. The experience is that there's a lot of conflict that goes on between even believers, or believers and their leaders, or leaders and their leaders, or one church with another church. And there's a lot of conflict that goes on in the churches. And so chapter 4 is really not an entirely new chapter. It's kind of the same topic, but it shifts the focus a little bit and kind of gets underneath a little bit more and looks at the heart. We're not really dealing with an entirely new topic here. So he asks this probing question at the beginning of verse 1. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts? We've already mentioned that they're there, but what's the source of them among you? What gives rise to them? The question is expressed in Greek by the word pothen, which is repeated with the word quarrel and with the word conflict. So it could be translated this way. Whence comes these quarrels? Whence comes these conflicts? Well, the question does look back to chapter 3. It's a diagnostic kind of question. It assumes that there is a source for the conflicts beyond the obvious, this person doesn't like this person, or something like that. It is a question that is not satisfied with saying quarreling in church is bad. We already know that. We kind of get that, right? That's not love when we quarrel in church. We got that. It's not satisfied at that level. It wants to go deeper. It wants to uncover the true ailment. Like that good surgeon, James wants to put his finger on the true problem. And so James is aiming his teaching not at what are you wearing this morning? What does your hair look like? Do you have a tattoo on? James is aiming his teaching, as all good Bible teachers and all good pastors will do, aims the teaching from the Scriptures right directly at our hearts. That's where God works. He works in your heart. Now, heart doesn't mean emotion only. Emotions are part of the heart. It also has to do with your choices, what you want. It also has to do with your thinking. The biblical term for heart doesn't really separate the thinking from the feelings. You know how sometimes we say, you know, in my head I think this way, but my heart I feel this way. But in the biblical sense, both New Testament and Old Testament, the heart is really includes the thinking. What do you think is true, and what do you value also in your emotions, and what are you going after in your life? It involves kind of all of that. It's your life center. It's your soul inside of you. He's aiming it right at you, who you really are. That's where his teaching is being aimed. And I'm glad he's doing that, because that's where real life change happens. If we change just a couple of things on the outside and say, look, I'm a good churchgoer and I'm not a worldly person, we're going to think that God's happy with us, but God's not happy with the way we think and the way we live. So he's really got to go after who we actually are on the inside, what really motivates us. And if he doesn't do that, then the kind of change is going to be superficial kind of change. Would you agree? We'll just change a few things and we'll be like all of the other false religions, right? Because they can conform to just a few things in Islam, and they can conform to just a few things in Catholicism, or they can conform to just a few things in Hinduism or Buddhism. There are all these rituals to do, and there's certain things you wear, certain ways you stand and do that. But the heart has to be changed. I think you'd agree with that. A heart has to not be worldly. That, by the way, is what Jesus' half-brother, Jesus, always did when he was preaching and changing lives in the Sermon on the Mount. If I look out at you right now, I wouldn't see any of you, and I'd say, you know what? We have a worldly person that walked into our congregation this morning. Look at how they are dressed. I don't think I would say that to any of you this morning. I mean, I can't see all of you all that well, but I don't see any of you that would say, there's a worldly person. And yet, there's a worldly person in the pulpit this morning. And there's a lot of worldly people in the pew this morning, at least sometimes in our thinking. And I think you'll see that as we go through this. I think you'll see that it's not so much about a styles of this or styles of that, but it's about where a heart really is. Now, each of these two nouns is actually a plural. It's not talking about one quarrel or one conflict, but he says conflicts and quarrels. That indicates that there's a chronic pattern of conflict in the church. Do you think that that's true? Now, you might not think that's true in this church. Actually, those of us in leadership know more of what's going on maybe than you do, and it's supposed to be kept that kind of a way, so there are conflicts. Sometimes you guys just solve your conflicts and bless you. You follow the Matthew 18 principle, and you have something wrong with someone. They looked at you wrong. You don't like how they spoke to you. You kind of settle that between two people, and that's good. That happens, and that's going on all the time. That's part of church discipline. But I'll tell you what, in churches in general, there's a lot of conflict. And often that conflict bubbles up, and it creates splits. It's a very very important topic for the church. Notice that he's asking this about conflicts among you. The among you is the same phrase used back in chapter 3, verse 13, if you want to go back and check that. Who among you is wise? Who in the congregation? Who in the church is wise? Well, these are conflicts inside of the church. What kind of conflicts? Well, the first word is the word quarrels. Polemos. Actually, the word could be translated warfare, battles and wars. That's how it usually would be translated. We get our English word polemics from it, ideological battles, wars, okay? It usually had to do with some prolonged combat. In fact, in Matthew 24, when Jesus was talking about things that would happen in the end times, he says, you're going to hear of wars and what? Rumors of war. Same word, right? You check out Revelation chapter 19, verse 19, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 34. It's used that way also there. It envisions soldiers carrying out a full military campaign, not a small little skirmish. This is big. The second term is a little bit like it, a little bit different. The term conflicts, it's pagē, and it refers more to strife of any kind and maybe smaller battles. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 23, it uses it for a verbal conflict. It says, refuse foolish and ignorant speculations, knowing that they produce quarrels. And there it is. Titus chapter 3 and verse 9 says, avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and strife and disputes. That's the same word, disputes, about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. In other words, Jews, and often a lot of Christians, loved to debate and argue and quibble and quarrel over all kinds of religious disagreements. Just get in each other's face and talk about this and talk about that. And it was really a lot of stuff that really didn't matter all that much, but they elevated these little things into big things. Both of these words became expressions of open antagonism. Church members at each other's throats, arguing, or worse. By the way, a lot of people say, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get back to the early church? You ever heard someone say that? If we could just be like the early church. Well, this is the early church. You know, if you had to put up with what James and Paul and John had to put up with, the word murder is in here. Did you notice that? Fighting and quarreling, murder. We're going to get to that. The modern church is not immune from quarreling. Church is split because of worldly mindset. Fights break out between leaders. Sometimes leaders are not even regenerate. They've been hanging on to their church for years and years and years, and someone comes along and says, let's do something different, and they're like, no. And they hang on to what they want to hang on to. Some of them are not even regenerate. And these fights break out and they split churches. Often the fight is over power and influence. I don't know how many churches I've heard of that have been split through my years now, over 30 years as a Christian, thinking about, wow, just church after church after church, a split from a split, you know. It's terrible. There's backbiting, there's jostling for position. There's mischaracterizing someone else's position, making someone seem worse than they actually are. That goes on all the time in politics, right? I mean, none of those politicians that I know of are really godly people, but the way they talk about each other, you think like they're straight out of hell, you know? Are they really that bad? You know, I don't think so. But we demonize one another. Why? Because then that makes our position seem so reasonable, right? Oh, they're just so bad. They said such and such. Well, maybe they had a bad day. Do you ever have a bad day? I do. Sometimes it starts with a feud. It might be two women feuding in the church. And then people gather around the two women, and now they're feuding with them, and now it becomes an open conflict. And now people start to pick sides. And then that becomes a battle. And then leaders are forced to pick sides, it seems. And there's no peace in the congregation. And soon they're like, well, we'll go our way. You go yours. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, I'm afraid that perhaps when I come, coming to the church at Corinth, I may find you to be not what I wish. That's sad, isn't it? I'm going to show up in town and I'm going to visit you as a church and I'm going to be really saddened that you're not what I wish you would be. And maybe found by you not to be what you wish, that perhaps there will be strife, jealousy, Angry tempers, disputes, slanders, gossip, arrogance, disturbances. I think at this point in time, it would be worthy just to go back and remind ourselves what's supposed to be going on in our minds and how we're supposed to be getting along. That would be verse 17 of chapter 3. Look back at that. The wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable and gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. Let me add Philippians 1:27 to that. Only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. That's what brings us together, beloved, the gospel in all of its dimensions. So James is asking for the source of these fights. And by asking this question, he's going to expose worldliness and link it to our hearts. Look, the answer comes next in verse 1. Look at it again. Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? That's a rhetorical question. It demands a positive answer. Yes, that's the source. Don't look anywhere else. Don't psychoanalyze the whole thing. Here it is. There's the source. It's the pleasures on your insides. Bingo. Finger is placed on the malady. There's the problem. You know, you've done the scanner and you can see the problem. There it is. The pleasures which wage war in your members. Pleasures. It's a word which refers to bodily appetites and gratifications. We get our word actually hedonism from it. It's a hedone, sensual pleasures. What's a hedonist? A hedonist who says life is about what I like and what I want and what I desire. Whatever feels good, do it. That's what hedonist is. It's a playboy philosophy of life. Does that sound kind of like our world? You ever gone through commercials and asked yourself, just kind of count them, check them off, how many of these commercials are appealing to my hedonistic tendencies? Because it's like 80% of them or something. It's a lot of them. Many of them are not, you know, being reasonable. They're just like, you're going to like this. This is going to feel good. You're going to enjoy this. It's all about that. Wine, women, and song. It's a commitment to the sensual party life. Are some of your friends like that? Are they committed to the sensual party life? That's because they have this philosophy. I think, though, James, given the context and the other words around it, he's probably using the term a little more broadly here, and not just physical pleasures, but any strong desire on the inside that we have. Lust for power, it could include. Lust for prestige. Lust for recognition. In the context, it likely points still to some wanting to elevate themselves. Earlier he said, let not many of you become teachers, as you will incur a stricter judgment. He asked, who among you is wise? And so there are people maybe wanting so bad to be recognized and so bad to be considered wise. And that's a strong urge and desire inside of them as well. And he may be addressing that as well. Where do these pleasures reside? Where do they come from? And his answer is in your members. He's not talking about the members of the body of Christ here. He's talking about yourself, your being individually, your members, your body parts. That's how he used it already in chapter 3 when he used the term. He's referring to the members of your body, like the tongue. I think that 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11 is an instructive cross-reference. Sometimes when you're trying to get the meaning of a text, it's good to do a little cross-reference, and you can find some that are very similar to this. There in 1 Peter 2:11, Peter writes, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers," that is, aliens and strangers in the world, "to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul." Those lusts inside of you that come from your flesh, that fallen humanity that's in you, they're waging war against literally your life, your soul. They are antagonists. They reside in your flesh and they launch a war. And it's a war against your soul, a war against the prosperity and the joy of your soul. I like Dr. Tasker's comments here. He says, human nature is indeed in the grip of an overwhelming army of occupation. Its natural aim is pleasure. And when we consider the amount of time, energy, money, interest, and enthusiasm that men and women give to the satisfaction of this aim, we can appreciate the accuracy of James's diagnosis. I wonder, those of you who have had some background in psychology, if you realize that the Bible gives a more penetrating and accurate diagnosis of what human problems really are. I wonder if you give the Bible that kind of credit, that it was way ahead of the so-called sciences of today. Psychology literally means the study of the soul. Does not the Bible do that? You will understand human motivation and human actions much better if you study your Bible than you study Freud, Skinner, cognitive therapy, or any of the others. Man is a creature created by God. If you don't get that, you don't understand humanity at all. Your anthropology is already deficient. Man is a creature, but now he's a creature at odds with his creator. That relationship of being at odds with his creator and what that has done to damage each individual human being, that has to be understood and appreciated before a diagnosis of what people's problems and behaviors and thought patterns are. If you miss that, you miss the whole thing. And a lot of psychology starts with ruling that out from the beginning. They start in the dark and they end in the dark. Man was made to be a worshiping creature. That's what's in his heart. He's created to worship one greater than himself, but he's so perverted now, he's turned that worship into other things. Worship of pleasure, worship of money, worship of the fame that he wants from other people, from being elevated in the eyes of other people, worship of himself. That's where he is. And you know, the thing about those kinds of worship is it's so frustrating to worship yourself. It's so frustrating to worship other people, to worship pleasure. You know why that's so frustrating? Because it never satisfies. You never grab what it is you want to grab. You go after it. It's right there, and you grab at it. And you find that it was air. It was empty. It didn't satisfy. And so it has built into its own punishment. When you go after that, when you live for your pleasures, you only get more frustration. And so then you keep lusting even more because now you feel even emptier. And it becomes an addiction. That's how one gets addicted. You can get addicted to anything you desire strongly enough. Not to view man primarily as religious is not to understand man at all. And not to be qualified to give a proper diagnosis of his soul. This explains true humanity. Look at it. It's ugly, but it's true. Not those other theories. Passing on false science. By the way, if it was science, why do they all disagree with each other? You know? Think about that for a minute. Why is there 25,000 different therapies? And they're all scientific theories. Really? Then why do they disagree with each other? If it's such settled science, why don't they agree? We all agree on gravity, right? I'd call that science. There is science and then there is falsely called science. Please don't miss the brilliance of this diagnosis. The reason there are battles and wars on the outside between people is that there are pleasures battling and warring on the inside. Gotta have it. I gotta have it. Those Redskins have to win today. No, I'll be okay. I'll be all right. Inside human beings, there is an incredible longing for something. What is it you're longing for? Have you ever really sat down and thought about that? Oh, I long for Jesus. Really? Do you? See, sometimes we think like, well, you know, I'm not longing for money. Well, but maybe you're longing for the things that money buys. You have to get into this a little bit and be honest, right? I just want peace and quiet. Yeah, you just want peace and quiet. You can really long for just having peace and quiet. I was in my backyard longing for peace and quiet, and my neighbor got upset at me, and it ruined my peace. I didn't like it. You want peace and quiet, like the testimony for parenting, you know, shoo the kids away. Stay away for 12 hours a day. Leave me alone. It's not good parenting, is it? What happens is we have things that we want. This is what I want. And you think it, you daydream about it. Oh, man, you have a plan. This is what would be great. Wouldn't this be great? And then someone gets in your way while you're trying to get what you want to get. You didn't have any intention in battling with them, but they're in your way. So now you have a problem with them. So the desire on the inside now becomes, I have a problem with you. That was my parking space. I had my signal on. I had to wait because Granny walked in front of me and she took 3 minutes to get there. That was mine. And you're angry. You're upset. I mean, that was already your spot. Now it is closer, it's raining out. You can get in the Target better that way. It becomes a conflict with other people because it's such a strong desire on the inside. The inner desire is so strong, it has to be vented. If it can't be vented, it'll be vented through fighting. Conflict within results in conflict without. This is brilliant. It's simple, but it's brilliant. You know, we have that saying that says, that person's making me angry. No, they're not. Your pleasures unfulfilled are making you angry. It could be as simple as, I just want people to leave me alone. I just wish I could get a good night's sleep. And I used to get so bothered, wake up in the middle of the night, I thought, now I'm up at 2, I'm up at 3, my whole next day is shot. Now all these plans, I want to get things done. Shot, it's gone. And now I've learned to embrace it. I get up, I go blogging. I start blogging and writing on that. I tried to change it. I had so many steroids with all the chemotherapy, it was waking me up. So I was like, you know what? I just got to give in here. I got to find something good to do with. I got to roll with the sovereignty of God here. And you know what? I was much more at peace, and I had some great times. I'm there blogging sometimes a couple hours, and then I get tired to go back to bed. The source of the conflict is not other people. It's not a lack of money. Well, you know why people are rioting in the streets, don't you? Just because they're poor. No. There are a lot of poor people that don't riot in the streets. Well, they're stealing because they were brought up in poverty. No. One of our leaders has been saying that, you know, global warming is causing all of the angry refugees. No, it's not. It may cause some poverty, but it doesn't cause the angry refugees. It's in the heart. This is simple. This can go a long way. This explains an awful lot here. If you believe it, if you understand it. The problem is not in your upbringing. Yeah, but you don't know my parents. Yeah, but I could find other parents that are as bad or worse, and I could find a believer that has come to grips with the sovereignty of God, has forgiven parents, and is moving on with love. And then what are you going to say? I know what you're going to say. Well, it was different. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is. Oh, man, we already know it. We already know it. There are brands of sight. Where's the personal responsibility in that? Some of you are thinking I'm being mean right now. I don't think so. I don't think I'm being mean. I think I'm a nice guy. I think it would be more mean, it would be more desperate to say the problem is something else because then you'd be trapped in it forever. Actually, if you come to grips with what this passage says, hearts and cleanse your hands, purify them, that you actually where's the responsibility? Right there on Cain's shoulders. Yes? Yes? Otherwise, God was a bad counselor because Cain didn't listen. We say, well, God failed in his first counseling attempt, you know. Try again, God. You didn't do too well with Cain. No. It's not about the counselor. The counselor just has to say the right things. The success depends on the say it. The counselee. In case you don't know what that is, that's the one getting counseled. That was Cain. And God was still gracious to him. These inner cravings throw us into conflict with other people. They get in the way. You ever seen someone on the highway risking everyone's life in all the cars around there just to get up there and get past, get there 5 minutes sooner? And so everyone now has to wonder whether or not their life is about to end because of that idiot. God forbid that idiot is you. Because one day you're going to drive and you'll be like, so that's the car. That's the car. All is good when the stores are filled. I mean, we're in America. We never get angry at each other. We go to the store, it has what we want. Doesn't have what we want, we'll order it. But what if it was the last one? And it's the day before Christmas. You've seen the movie plot with that, right? People go crazy. That's not so far-fetched. People have pleasures. They have desires. What's the lottery up to now, do you know? You shouldn't know. You shouldn't know. Forget about it. Some guy's bought 500 tickets, and he's going to be cussing. He's going to be angry. He's going to kick his dog. He's going to blame his wife. He's going to have conflict. Some people really are going to be upset this next week, deeply upset if their football team loses. Really, they are. They're going to be so down because that's their life. Some lust for a dainty vacation house. Some for that stylish dress in the store window. Some for sexual fulfillment. Some for their dinner meal. There's a lot of them. If you're going to make headway against worldliness, you have to start with confession and responsibility and faith before God that He can change people like you. He's in the business of changing people like you. He did it before you were born. He found some people that were like you. He changed them. There's saints all the way through church history. You don't think that they were any different than you or me, right? He's in the business of changing people. Some people had your terrible personality. Some people were hard to get along with like you. Some people had the same way of thinking that you had. God changed them. God worked on them. God changed them. You can have that happen to you. You have to believe that. You're not unique. 1 John 1:8, if we say that we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves and the truth's not in us. You know, the lost, the unsaved, the unregenerate, they're absolutely controlled by their pleasures. You and I are not. They're totally controlled by their pleasures, whatever they may be. But they think they're free. That's the crazy thing about it. They think they're free. They look at us and say, you're shackled with all that religion. Oh, no. Our religion is wings. They're shackled. They just don't get it. 2 Peter chapter 2, speaking out arrogant words of vanity. Vanity. They entice by fleshly desire, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. What an ironic statement. Promising other people freedom while they're chained to the wall with their lust. Then it goes on, for by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved. They love their sexual immorality. They love their homosexuality and press for it. But it only brings them disease, depression, destruction, divorce. They know the right thing to do in many cases, but they don't want it. They don't do it. It's even a war with inside of them. Now, James wants to make sure that we understand what he means. So next he extrapolates and he illustrates it there in verse 2. We're only at verse 2. How this lusting for pleasure works. Look at verse 2. You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. Let's stop there. James is illustrating this with two parallel statements. By the way, the punctuation in the Greek is rather difficult here in this verse, so some of your English translations will be different than what I just read, but I think the NASB has it to smooth this and bringing out the parallel to these two statements. The first statement is, you lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. Lust is the strong desire here. It's referring to a wrong and evil kind of a desire. Lusting is coordinated with the pleasures in our body. Members, back in verse 1, and here James says, you lust for it, but you don't have it. They're lusting, they're wanting, they're going after it, they're pursuing it, but they keep grasping at it, and they just never quite get it. I think that's very instructive. It shows that in most cases, people who are lusting after worldly things never get it. They never even get it. So often we're sitting there saying, I shouldn't lust. Have you ever told yourself that even if you do lust, you're not going to get it? What did 1 John 5:17 say? 1 John 2:17 say? The lusts are passing away. The world is passing away and also its lusts. It's going away. People don't get what they want. And even if they get it for a moment, they don't get it for that long. Then they have to worry about keeping it. And that's hard. Once in a while, people get everything they want. You hear the story, this guy's rich. He wins the lottery. He has everything he wants. The home, the car, the women, the lifestyle, the retirement, the travel. And you wait a couple of years and you read about the same guy, he's bored to death. You know, money really can't buy happiness. It can't. You'll have to find happiness some other way. You find more happiness giving the money to people who are hurting. Much, much more happiness that way. He'd be so happy with himself. He'd be happy with God. There'd be joy in giving and giving and giving. It's more blessed to give than to receive, right? Money can't buy you love. Money can't buy happiness. And they get the beautiful girl. You know, in high school, they're lusting after, I gotta get that girl. To get the girl, to find out, marry the girl, and the girl's selfish. And every other guy wants the same girl. And now she's looking around at the other guys, and the guys are looking at her, and what kind of a marriage is that? It ends up not being quite what you thought it was going to be, right? Or girls, you'll have to reverse that for the guy, you know? And he's inconsiderate, you know? He throws stuff on the ground all the time. You know, he doesn't think about you at all. But there he is, you know, great-looking guy. That's all you were looking at. That's what you got, you see. The great car, you get the great car. Finally, I got the great car. That's been something I haven't worked on. You know, I got midlife crisis. I got to get that car. I got to get me that car. I know. First, second, third time I take that out, someone's going to ding the door. I just know it. Waited 55 years, and look at that, Lord. It'll be a sermon in and of itself right there at that spot. It will. You get what you want. Does it satisfy? It's so frustrating to try to keep things new and nice. Stock market's going down. You're going to invest in gold? What are you going to do with the gold? Where are you going to hide it? The backyard? Dig a hole? It's going to be hard. Most of the time, though, you don't even get what you're lusting for. That's the exception. You only wish, you only keep dreaming. And your thoughts start to consume you. And then they start to become the entire way you think about life. It becomes overwhelming in your thought process. Burning desire. But you just keep coming up empty-handed, and life becomes so disappointing. And you have to live without. And you start to become sour and bitter and withdrawn and professional. And life just not working out the way I wish it would work out. The consequences for lusting and not getting can be devastating. It can get so bad. Look what follows. It's shocking. He says, so you commit what? Murder. That's how you have to say that word. You can't say murder. You have to say murder. Because it's an angry word. By the way, interpreters have a very hard time believing that James is referring to literal murder here. Or if murder was really going on in the churches, whew, you would think, A, that James would have brought this subject up a little earlier in his letter. B, wouldn't this prove that there were some in the church who were completely unregenerate? Yes, we already knew that. C, wouldn't these people be arrested and not be part of the church anymore? So many interpret this murder as figurative murder, like Jesus talked about in Matthew 5, 21 and 22, the Sermon on the Mount, again, that James might be thinking about, where he says, when you have hatred in your heart for your brother, you've already murdered him, right? Or John uses it in 1 John. He says, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. However, really, honestly, the easiest way to interpret this, and you always go with the most probable interpretation in the context, although I don't rule out a figurative understanding as well, but I think the easiest way here is that at least in some of the conflicts, at least in some of the churches, it got so bad, somebody killed somebody else. Now, that would make a headline today, wouldn't it? How's that so? Well, this is just speculation. Some of the converts from Judaism into the Messianic movement, into the way, into Christianity, to come out of the Zealot movement. One of Jesus' 12 disciples was Simon the what? The Zealot, right? And what did they do? They killed people. They solved their problems with violence. Maybe some of them like that were in the church now in Judea or the greater dispersed area, and maybe some of them haven't gotten all the sanctification they should have, and one of them killed another. I don't know. At the very least, James is warning that this is where a conflict will eventually lead if it is not controlled, right? Hatred, unchecked, produces violence, and that can lead to murder. And by the way, you and I are not immune from the possibility of murdering somebody else. How can you say that, Pastor? Because King David was a man after God's own heart, and he made sure that Uriah, the husband of the wife he coveted and wanted so badly because of her beauty, he made sure that that fella, faithful soldier as he was, went to the front of the lines and was killed. It's the equivalent of murder. He loved himself so much. I'm the king, my palace, I want that woman. Must have been a very beautiful woman. We know today that pulling the trigger only comes after intense hatred. The problem, by the way, is not with the gun, unless it goes off by itself. The problem wasn't with the sword in Jesus' day. Many of them carried swords. The problem was with the heart and the hatred of the person that was using it. Murderous desires lead to murder. So James is right in warning about this great evil of murder. I think this is an appropriate place, and I'll end with this, to remind us that abortion is murder. Abortion is murder. Little babies in the womb, and we have some of them in the womb here, right, in the congregation, do we not? And praise God for loving and caring mommies, you know? But little babies in the womb are real human beings. They're not half human beings. They're real human beings. So says biology. So says common sense. So says the scriptures. Taking the life of a baby in the womb for the sake of maintaining one's pleasures is not a woman's right. It is murder. Murder against the most vulnerable and weak members of society who have no voice to speak for them at all. In ancient Rome and Greece, infanticide was a very common practice. It was even defended by the Romans and the Greeks as a way to keep their civilization strong. It was considered good and moral that if a father did not want a child after it was born, leave it out and expose it or take it down to the water and drown it. And most of the victims were little baby girls whose dad wanted a son. Christians, as they spread through the Roman Empire, spoke strongly against infanticide, but they had no political power in Rome. They called it murder, and they were right. The pagan religions practiced it, but Christians would not. Eventually, when Constantine came to power, he began to change things. He opened up the treasuries of the palace to care for unwanted children. Sometime after his reign, infanticide was completely abolished from the Roman Empire because of the influence of Christianity. Beloved, abortion is infanticide in the womb. And whereas the ancients drowned their babies or abandoned them out to exposure, abortion is worse, for it often is a violent destruction of a poor, innocent life. Abortion should be outlawed. And the heart that leads to wanting to have an abortion so they can keep, in many cases, not in all cases, a sinful lifestyle That is worldliness, and that is murderous. And God forbid that we would turn our hearts to murder in any of the forms that we might think, that we would check our hearts. We're going to continue on next week, God willing. We're going to keep looking at this passage and the diagnosis and the cure and all of that. It's a very powerful passage. I pray it speaks to each of you. If you would need to speak to a spiritual leader, you would like to talk to a pastor, I will be up front, and I would love to talk with you. I can even set up a meeting with you if you'd like to talk at some other time. Come on down to the front, talk with me. I'd love to talk with you. I'm much nicer when I'm not in the pulpit. You can come talk to me. I don't bite. I'd love for you to come down front and just share with me what's on your heart. Father, thank you for the blessing of your word. It's hard to hear, but it's so true. And do the surgery in our hearts you need to do. We ask it in Jesus' blessed name, the giver of life. Amen.